So this morning I wanted to give a talk carrying on from one of the questions last night. One of the great things about the question time, it does actually prompt me to be able to expand on some of the interesting comments which were made. And this morning's talk, I'm going to talk much more on mindfulness, but also on the place of effort as well, and effort and mindfulness, because that's always a confusing part in the practice of meditation. Exactly what mindfulness is, how to develop it, and what part effort plays in all of this. And the reason I always encourage people to do less, to calm the mind down, to actually make more peace, is because one of the biggest problems with people meditating is their restless mind, thinking too much. And because they're thinking too much and understanding that all thinking comes from the activity of the mind called the controller, the more we can actually calm down that controller, let it go, relax, be still, the easier it is to stop the biggest hindrance of thinking. But nevertheless, there has to be some effort there, because sometimes people sit down there, they do absolutely nothing, and well, they think they're doing nothing, but what actually they're happening, they just go into dullness or thinking all sorts of thoughts, and they never get the benefit of meditation that way either. So, as a rule of thumb here, it's to be still. To get that peace, you have to learn how to do nothing. But to be mindful, to know what you're doing, you have to create effort. It is the effort which actually creates the mindfulness and generates it and makes it strong, so that you know that you're doing nothing, which is an important thing to be able to perceive. Too often in meditation, people think, oh, I'm letting go, I'm not doing anything. But you are doing so much, and there's expectations, there's memories, there's plans, there's controlling, but because of our lack of mindfulness we just cannot see it, which is why the meditation does not develop as deeply as it should. So today I'm going to talk more about the cultivation of mindfulness. And I use the saying that, you know, mindfulness is generated through effort, simply because it does need an energy of the mind to be able to see very clearly. And sometimes that energy of the mind is produced just by physical effort, even just when you first wake up in the morning. I know this is a retreat time and you're not used to getting up so early, but nevertheless, if you've got to get up, you might as well get up and enjoy it, and get up well. Which is why that in my monastery, down in Serpentine, and also down in here in these retreats, we always say, and I think it's on the schedule, rise with gusto. And what gusto means is don't just roll out of your bed, have a look at the clock and think, my God, 4 o'clock. You know, and this is the Easter holidays, you know, who will get up at this time in the morning and just roll back again and to sleep? No, you actually just jump out of your bed and just you jump up, sort of you say zippity-doo-dah, and then you look at your clock. And the reason I remember that is because this last week we had Ajahn Yanadamma visiting our monastery down at Serpentine, and so often we have these visiting monks coming to stay, and it reminded me of many, many, many years ago when Ajahn Sumedho came to stay, and we were so short of accommodation that I volunteered actually to give up my hut, and I stayed in the storeroom. And the storeroom is about 2 meters long by about 1.5 meter wide. And it's got lots of shelves and full of stuff, you know, the monks' robes, spare bowls, toothpaste and stuff like that. And the only place I could lay down, you know, was actually by either putting my head next to the door, and you get a cold that way, or putting my leg next to the door and my head under the shelf. And I, you know what happened next. I'm training this mindfulness practice of jumping out and first thing in the morning. And I forgot, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, you forget where you are. You know, you think you're in your own little hut, you can jump up. And I jumped up and my goodness, I banged my head. And I haven't been the same since. I really hurt. Because I just got up for the jumping up and zippity-doo-dah, but I never said zippity-doo-dah that day. I won't tell you what I said. But you really cracked your head. But anyhow, you know, I realised you've got to get up, so why not get it over and done with? Because sometimes it's very painful getting up, so you just jump up, You put energy when you're getting up and you're more awake, you're more alert. So the quicker you get up, the more energy you have to start the day with. The slower you get up, as you crawl, sort of, you know, just like if you're crawling through sticky treacle to try and get out of your bed. And it's just so hard to put those covers off. The blankets, they're very light when you go to sleep, but they weigh a ton when you first wake up in the morning. They're so hard to throw off. The way you actually can do that, you jump up and you've got energy. And that energy is also inner happiness as well. And that inner happiness is also mindfulness. Because these three things go together. Because you know what happens if you get up very slowly and lazily and just roll out and, oh, I don't want to do this, but I suppose I have to do this. And you know, you just slowly just make your way to the toilet and you find you're not in the toilet, you go into somebody's room because you're so sort of lack of mindfulness. So be careful about that, because when you're really slow and dozy in the morning and you don't put forth effort, you're not really clear what you're doing and what's happening. And that means lack of mindfulness. So the more you put a bit of energy into get up in the morning, and whatever else you're doing, you know, put effort and energy into it, put life into it, the more awake, the more aware you are. So even when you have your chores to do, you know, just... Now washing the dishes or wiping them. Don't just go wiping them just, you know, very, very, very reluctantly. Just really put effort and energy in there and just see how much. See if you can wear out the tea towels by rubbing them so hard. Whatever it is, when you really put effort and energy into it, you wake up and you get alive, you get energetic. So these are like some ways we can create this awareness, this alertness called mindfulness. We become brighter in our mind. Which also means, as I said this morning, if you really are getting sleepy, please take those blankets off. It's not that freezing that you're going to die, you know, in this place in the morning, but it just makes you more awake, more alert when it's a little bit colder. Or, you know, if you really want to really test yourself out, just go and sit outside in the early morning. Because you know, outside it's not so cozy and safe and comfortable as inside a room. And it's more awake outside. So you can sit outside under a tree. And that really wakes you up, especially when you're sitting under a tree and the sprinklers go on. But that's good, it means you have your shower at the same time. So take your soap out there in the morning and you don't need to take the shower. But we create that mindfulness, that alertness, that awakeness, by putting a bit of energy into what we're doing. And that's also with the way we meditate as well. Now don't always be a creature of habit, because mindfulness dies when you always do the same thing over and over and over again. So which is why you try not always to sit in the same posture when you're meditating. So change it around a bit. Turn around. If you put your left hand over your right hand when you meditate, try putting your right hand over your left hand. Swap it around a bit. There's that basic exercise in mindfulness goes that when you brush your teeth in the morning, which part of the teeth do you start with? The top left, the middle, top, the right, the bottom, inside, outside? Tomorrow or this evening, start at a different place in your mouth. What it does, it means you have to be more alert to what you're doing. Even when you're eating, you know, try and eat in a different way. Whatever it is, but try and break the habits. Because when we have a retreat such as this, you know, when everything is sort of organized for you, when you don't have to do very much, it's very easy to slip into dullness and get into a routine. So see if you can break that routine up a bit. Because when you break up that routine, you have to be more alert, more awake. And that is the beginning of mindfulness. You have to know. But as I mentioned yesterday, that's only half of mindfulness, this alertness and this awakeness. The other half of mindfulness is actually remembering what you're supposed to be doing. So very often that mindfulness was described by the Buddha to be like a supervisor at work. A supervisor at work has to be very alert, watching over all the workers, but also has to know all the workers' tricks. You know, how they can somehow get away, you know, with doing the work. And once you know all the tricks, and you know you can actually watch those workers, you can actually keep them on the job. So you have to know like the tricks of the mind. Just how it can deceive you, how it can just go off and play around and do nothing and try and convince you that this is important and this is necessary. So you know the instructions and you keep the mind on those instructions. Which is why that it was very helpful many years ago when I started teaching meditation in terms of stages. Simply because it gave clear instructions of what you're supposed to do, or rather where you're supposed to be going. So it's like your supervisor, the mindfulness, had very clear instructions on what it should be doing. A present moment awareness, silence, and watching the breath, the full awareness of the breath, from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. To be able to watch the gaps between the breaths, from the beginning of an out-breath to the end of the out-breath, having that full awareness there. And being able to allow that full awareness to develop into the delightful, or what I call the beautiful breath. And after the beautiful breath disappears, you see this beautiful light in the mind, the nimitta. This monk here sees the nimitta every morning, but it's that spotlight right in his face. You've got to be very careful sometimes. It looks like a spotlight sometimes, those beautiful lights, but once you know exactly where you are, then it becomes much easier to instruct your awareness. To know the instructions, to know exactly what you're supposed to be doing. And a very skillful means of doing that, of helping that, is using that simile, or that metaphor of a supervisor at work. Is making sure you give your supervisor clear instructions. So sometimes at the beginning of a meditation, you can tell your mindfulness, instruct it. I will now be aware of the present moment. I will now be aware of the present moment. I will now be aware of the present moment. And also tell your supervisor what it shouldn't be watching. Anything to do with the past. Anything which has not yet happened, I will not be concerned with. Anything to do with the past, anything concerned with the future, I will not pay attention to. Anything concerned with the past, anything to do with the future, I will not pay attention to. So you give your supervisor clear instructions, exactly what you wanted to do. That's the effort. And then you let go and let the supervisor do its work. It will take a few minutes for the supervisor, for your mindfulness, to complete its task. What happens when you've given that clear instructions? Your mindfulness will be watching this moment. When a thought of the future comes up, because you've had those instructions, the mindfulness will say, stop, no, don't do it. The mindfulness is active there in stopping you from shirking your task, from moving away from the business you're supposed to be doing. The mindfulness is there watching over you. And when you make an error, it brings you back into line. When you start lingering on the past, mindfulness comes up, stop it. Come back into the present. If you've given yourself those clear instructions at the beginning of each stage, then there's a good chance mindfulness, your supervisor, will keep those instructions in mind, will be mindful of the instructions, and will help you settle into that stage. And once you've got the stage of, say, present moment awareness, then you can interrupt and say to the mindfulness, great, now we want you to be silent. Silent present moment awareness. We want you to be silent in silent present moment awareness. We want you to be silent in silent present moment awareness. And just to make it very clear, tell the supervisor, no words, no thoughts, no commentary. No words, no thoughts, no commentary. No words, no thoughts, no commentary. So your supervisor knows very clearly, you just told it a moment ago, exactly what you want it to do. And then you let the supervisor do its work, that's when you sort of stop and do nothing. And because your mindfulness is just being told, it's very easy for it to remember those instructions, and it will help guide you automatically. You don't need to give any more instructions, just let the mindfulness do the work. It's like the simile which I've given some time ago of the taxi driver. For those of you who've come from overseas or interstate, I'm not sure, maybe when we finish this retreat on Saturday, that you will order a taxi and go straight to the airport to catch a flight home. And if that's the case, there are two types of people. The first type of person, as soon as they get into the taxi, they tell the taxi driver, I want to go to the airport, the international airport, Terminal 2. And I want you to go not too fast because I'm a Buddhist and you have to be compassionate. And if anyone wants to come in because they're trying to turn in, please let them come in. Please just stop at all the red lights, don't run the lights and keep to the left. And please don't talk too loud because I've just been meditating, I want to be quiet. And don't rush and don't beep the horn. And if you give instructions like that before you even get out the car park, the taxi driver will throw you out the taxi. The taxi driver said, look, I know how to get to the airport, I know how to drive, I'll drive my way, you shut up and I'll get you there. And that simile, this is sometimes the way we meditate. And we say, come on, present moment awareness, come and get in the present moment. Now don't do it this way, do it that way. Now come into the present moment, not in the present moment yet. How many times do I have to tell you, get into the present moment. And don't be too hard, don't be too soft, get in the present moment. We think so much and give so many instructions. No wonder the mind gets confused and it does not know what to do. You may be aware, but you can't really be mindful of the instructions because the instructions are just too complicated. If anyone has ever been a manager, you know that one of the skills of leadership is the ability to give clear instructions, to convey it perfectly so people will not get confused. Sometimes even that when I'm being driven to an appointment and I say turn left at the lights, I have to add when the lights are green. Sometimes people think, oh, they've got so much faith in the monks, they can turn a red light, run a red light and they won't get caught because the monks will protect them somehow. So you have to give clear instructions. Okay, you know, you're straight ahead at the junction, but only wait until the lights are green before you go through. So sometimes, and that's not a joke, there's one person, I won't tell you who it is, but one driver, you have to be very, very, very clear, otherwise he would try and go through the red light. He said, you told me to. So I have to give very clear instructions. And if you're a manager and you do give clear instructions, then it's more likely that your mindfulness will follow those instructions and get to where you want it to go. So give those clear instructions, but not too many. I like to give those instructions 3 times to myself, not more than that. And I try and make it very precise in my own words, exactly what I want to do and what I shouldn't be doing, those 2 things, to make it clear. And then you just say, watch the breath. If you don't know what to watch, then watch that feeling which tells me the breath is going in or the breath is going out. And I then say, I say that for 3 times to myself, I usually just say, okay, watch the breath, watch the breath, watch the breath. And then what I'm not supposed to do not pay attention to any other feelings in the body, nor sounds outside of you. Do not pay any attention to any feelings in the body, nor sounds outside. Do not pay any attention to any feelings in the body, other than the breath, or sounds outside. Just make it very clear. And when you sort of give those precise instructions, what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do, you are establishing mindfulness. You're giving it a chance to work. You're taking exactly what it's supposed to be doing. And it's wonderful that when you understand what I'm talking about here and you do tell the mindfulness exactly what it's supposed to be doing, all the confusion disappears. The mindfulness, once it's awake and alert, can be precisely on the job. rather than getting all confused and sometimes doing other things. Because sometimes you can be aware, but you don't know what you're aware of, or you're aware of the wrong things, you know, simply because you didn't follow the instructions, or rather, the instructions weren't clear enough to you. So you just wandered around aimlessly. So by programming your mindfulness that way, by giving yourself clear instructions, it's very easy for the mind to do the job. And that's an important part of mindfulness. For those of you, again, who have problems in the meditation, again, you can program your mindfulness, instruct the mind what it's supposed to do. Now, if you keep thinking too much and you still haven't got any peace from the thinking mind, you know, when you sit down, you close your eyes and your body is relaxed, then you can tell yourself, I will be aware of the space between my thoughts. When one thought ends and the other one hasn't begun yet, I'll pay special attention there. I'll pay special attention to the space between my thoughts. When one thought is finished, another one hasn't begun. I really look out for that. Say it in your own words about 3 times. And because you've set up your mindfulness that way, it remembers the instructions for that one sit. And that's what you've been looking out for. And you get to know that beautiful silence between the thoughts. It's a strange thing, but that has always been there. And everybody, even the people who think they're always thinking, they do have many spaces between their thoughts. It's only they haven't recognized that yet. They're dull in that, they're not looking out for it, so they don't notice it's there. And just to know that much, that there are spaces between your thoughts, and look out for them, will give you your first experience of silence, and will help you appreciate you're not a compulsive thinker. You do have moments of peace, it's just you weren't mindful enough to notice them. And once you do put your awareness, attentiveness to those silent places, because you've told yourself to, and you keep that instruction in mind, a great thing happens is the space between the thoughts grows. What you're attentive to usually grows. Just basic psychology. If you pay attention to all the faults in yourself or the faults in the retreat center, you tend to see even more faults. If you're attentive to, you know, the beauty, the wonderful things happening in this retreat, or the beauty and the peace in yourself, that grows. Whatever you pay attention to, sort of grows. That's why people pay attention to the thoughts, that's all they see, and this mind is full of thoughts. But if they pay attention to the space between the thoughts, there is that silence there. So there are many instructions which you get from meditation, and I don't want to sort of complicate it too much here, but those basic instructions of the stages of meditation. Give yourself those instructions, tell yourself exactly what you want to do and how you want to do it, what you're not supposed to do at every stage, even though it does mean interrupting the silence at the beginning of every stage. It does help. Until such time as you don't need to give those instructions anymore, because your mindfulness is well trained, it knows exactly what to do and it knows exactly when to do it. And then your supervisor is a very, very great help for your meditation. Always looking over what you're doing, knowing exactly where you are and what you need to do, or rather what you need to avoid doing. And that takes energy and effort to put in those instructions. And that's, you know, really where the effort should be going into. Training the mindfulness, making it strong so it becomes a powerful help to your meditation, which is why the Buddha called it, he called it an indriya, one of the most powerful of the controlling faculties for meditation. You become more alert, you remember the instructions, you find yourself, you know, walking the path in a more efficient way. But with remembering those instructions, you find that that alertness starts to grow as well. The mindfulness gets stronger. This is the awareness gets stronger. And the reason it gets stronger is because the alertness, the awareness, once it's arisen, once it's aroused with a bit of effort, just because you are being more simple and more still, more calm, doing less, you do have more energy to give to your mindfulness. You know what it's like in the world? You've got so many other things to do. You work so much, and that takes up most of your energy. And you've got very little left for meditation or mindfulness. In a retreat situation, as I mentioned yesterday, the first 2 days, 3 days, you're going to be catching up on your energy. But because you're not doing very much, you're not forcing yourself, you have very few responsibilities, it's nature, it has to happen, your energy levels start to rise. You start to feel more alert. You have more oomph and less sleepiness. Basically, the mindfulness starts to grow in intensity just because you're not doing very much. And when actually that mindfulness goes strong enough, you can start really getting into the meditation, and you can actually follow these stages. In each of these stages, you're doing less and less and less and less. When you're in the present moment, you've got many things you can do and think about. In the silence, you can't even think about it. In the breath, you can't hear sounds, you can't feel the body, it's just the breath going in and out. You're simplifying and simplifying and simplifying and simplifying. And the more you simplify, the less energy you waste. The less energy you waste, the more energy you have. Basically, mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. Which is why that many years ago I started mentioning the different degrees of mindfulness. It's just not mindfulness, 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 it's all the same. It's also its intensity and strength. And I started using words such as power mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. And these are important words to understand. Now you find as you go through this retreat, your mindfulness increases in its strength. It's the same as this morning, we didn't have any lights on when I first came in here this morning, so I couldn't even see my watch. I had to just walk out there to find out whether it's 6 o'clock yet to start the morning chanting. When it's very dark, you can hardly see anything. As they start to turn the lights up, you can see more. When you have the light of the early morning, you can see much more. But if I put these spotlights on, you can see even more. As a man, when you shave in the morning, sometimes you don't want to put the full light on because you can always see the stubble left even after you've had a shave. And sometimes, you have shaving in some of these hotel rooms or whatever, they have this beautiful light in there, you can see everything. And no matter how many times I've put that razor across my cheek, there's always something left. So I much prefer to shave in the in the mid-dark because you can't see so much. This is what happens. The brighter it is, the more you can see. And this is what the mind is like. The mindfulness gets sharper and sharper and sharper, more and more intense. And that's part of what we're doing here, to increase the power of mindfulness. We start that off with a bit of effort, and the effort to instruct the mind. But it's really the stillness which starts really generating the energy. And once that stillness gets very, very strong, the energy of mindfulness gets very, very powerful. And that's when you start really having fun in your meditation. Once the mindfulness is very, very bright, that's when you start looking at the carpet and you go, wow, look at that. And there's so many stories that, some of the carpets, you see the carpet here in front of you, this dirty old moth-eaten sort of carpet in front of you. And you probably never even noticed it, except sort of the patches where it's been worn away. But you'll find that when mindfulness starts to get very strong, you look at that carpet, and you go, wow, look at that. That's amazing. Like someone's put some psychotropic substance in the muesli. They haven't put any drugs in the muesli, it's just the power of mindfulness, that's what it does. They've got lots of lovely stories about that. And this one time when I was walking doing walking meditation during the rains retreat in Wat Nanachat in northeast Thailand. The old sala had a concrete floor. It's now been tiled with these plastic tiles. And that's almost broke my heart when I heard they put tiles on that floor. Because the reason was, one day when I was walking meditation there in the hall, I had to stop because the concrete in front of me, wow, you've never seen such beautiful, amazing concrete in your life. The different grays and the way they were arranged and the texture of the whole concrete was like a Picasso. And I looked at it in just awe. It looked so wonderful. I actually did think of actually cutting it out with a saw and sending it to the London Tate Gallery. It was the most amazing sort of picture I'd ever seen. And I actually stopped and stood there for about half an hour just gazing at this beautiful piece of concrete. I'd never seen anything so beautiful before. And of course, at the time, you don't think you're going crazy. You know, you're just enjoying yourself immensely. I don't know what other people thought. Perhaps they knew about meditation and they gave me the space just to stare like an idiot at this beautiful piece of concrete. And then afterwards, the mindfulness started fading away, and so did the beauty of the concrete. And that was one of the first experiences of, I knew about what happens when the mindfulness gets strong. Even that ordinary piece of concrete looks beautiful, looks amazing. Simply because you've got such a strong mind, the mindfulness is getting so bright, whatever you look at, wow, I never realized so much was going on in there. And this is what will happen to you. Whether it's a piece of concrete or a leaf outside or one of the bricks in the wall, you look at it and think, wow, I never realized there's so many colors. You know, just that one little brick. And its shape is just, wow, it's amazing. You're getting into what we call power mindfulness, which is why it gets enormous fun. Whatever you look at, you take a banana and you spend your whole breakfast just looking and admiring a banana. If that happens to somebody, don't think they're crazy. Don't call the guys in white coats. They're just having a nice power mindfulness experience. And it's really good fun. Your mind is becoming aware. Now, of course, that's not really what you're supposed to be doing, but enjoy yourself whenever you get a bit of power mindfulness coming along. You're just seeing deeper into things. And it's showing you something very important. If you're going to get into these deep states of meditation, they're so subtle, you need that degree of power in your mindfulness to make it work. At every stage in the meditation, such as like the nimittas stage, you need quite strong mindfulness to stay in that stage. If you come out afterwards, in the nimitta stage, you usually have power mindfulness. If you sit in a nice nimitta for a few minutes, you come out afterwards and look at the carpet. Wow! This is what happens. The mind is getting very powerful and strong. The energy of mindfulness is increasing. And this is not just the energy of mindfulness. This is where the happiness comes from as well. There's one very important piece of Dhamma which not enough monks and teachers talk about, which is the energy of mindfulness is internal happiness. That's where the bliss comes from in meditation. When you're very, very strong and mindful, what you see is just so beautiful, it just feeds enormous happiness. And that happiness gives more power to the mindfulness, and the mindfulness sees more and it gets more blissful. You've got that nice feedback mechanism between mindfulness and happiness. They go together. Which is why as this meditation retreat goes on, when you wake up, you not only see more and it becomes more interesting and fascinating, but you have a good time. So you've already gone through the first dull day of the meditation retreat. It's going to get better and better, and better and better and better. And bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Who knows, if you follow the instructions and do it properly, you really get high. Simply because the mindfulness has become powerful. And you start to see into things. And you see something which is really beautiful and interesting. It engages you. You can look upon simple things and hold your attention there for a long time. Which is why that we do these practices to build up that mindfulness. to make it strong, literally to wake up. And we wake up, the life becomes more interested, fascinating, more beautiful. And then we can use that mindfulness to focus on any insights, if we want to. To focus on our body. Just see that it's just a body, that's all. And with that strength, that happiness and that power to be still on something, it's very easy just to see what's going on there. And just to let it all go. Whether it's our possessions, whether it's our food, or whatever else. It's so easy to let it go when the mind is awake and sees everything clearly. And then we can go on to other things, such as in our mind. But I'll talk about the insight practices later on. And this particular talk is just upon mindfulness. How it's generated, how it's created. And I can't sort of pass by. Now, perhaps the most evocative simile, which again many of you, because you come to every retreat which I give just about, have heard many times, the simile of the hill up to Bodhinyana Monastery. Hopefully when you've heard that simile, you've done something about it and maybe walked up the road to your house, because that particular simile was Serpentine Monastery, 2.16 kilometers from the bottom of the hill to the gate. And for the first 9 years I was living in that monastery, I'd always go up and down that hill in a car or some sort of vehicle. And it was about 9 years, I was coming back from some appointment, I got back about 9:30, a beautiful spring morning, so I got out of the car, I asked the driver, "Now lead me to the bottom of the hill, I've got plenty of time, I can walk up and I'll see you at our lunch." So he let me out at the bottom of the hill and I walked up, thinking I'd just do it for the exercise because it was a beautiful morning. But the strange thing which happened was, as soon as I started walking up that hill, I could not recognize anything of my surroundings. It was a completely different hillside for me. And that started, making me think, what's going on here? Am I going crazy again? And I looked and looked, I couldn't recognize what I was seeing. So I stopped, and as I stood still, the hillside changed again. And you explain that very easily, having been a scientist before, when you are looking through the window of a moving car, the light which reaches the back of your eye on the retina does not have enough time to form a full image before a new light comes along, dislodges the old, and now you have to attend to that. The images flash by too quickly to fully form. When you go slower, the light has more time, the intensity is greater before it has to move off, the colors are richer, and the detail is more pronounced. That's why when I walked, I was going slow enough to see many details I hadn't perceived before. They were always there, but I was going too fast to see them. When I slowed down, I could see those. And there were so many new details I saw in that hillside, that was why it looked completely different, and I could not recognize it from what I remembered seeing through the window of a speeding car. And then, when I stopped, that was the time my eyes had enough time, full time, for the colors to fully form. And what, through the window of a car, was a pastel color, now was so rich and vibrant. And details which I hadn't stopped long enough to see now became very clear. I remember I think at school, when we had in our science class, and we were developing our own photographs. In the age before digital photography, when you had these negatives, and you had a photographic paper, and you went into a dark room, and you developed your own photographs. Now, as you watch that photographic film, You know, and as you put it in that chemicals, the developer, the image came out slowly. You could actually see it sort of developing. That's what it's called developing, as a chemical reaction happened. If you took it out too soon, and again, it would be just too grey and not fully formed. You had to leave it in plenty of time for the colours and the detail to really become manifest. And that was the simile which I used at that time. When I was going too fast, the image didn't have enough time to form and develop. That's why it was washed out. It never had any depth or beauty or detail. When I went slower, the detail had time to form, and so did the beauty. Which is why, at the end, when I stopped still and looked at that hillside, only then did I see what was really going on there, and it was beautiful. And that's a simile for mindfulness. Because we move so fast, we don't see very much. We just quickly give it a name, move on to the next object. We move so fast, we see so little. But as you get more and more still through this practice of meditation, as you learn to linger more with things, instead of moving on to the next thing, what's going to happen next? What should I do next? You stay where you are, you linger, you stop. You start to see more. And what you see much more detail, the colours are richer, and it's more enjoyable. Which is why this practice of deepening your mindfulness is a very pleasant, happy process. Once you get it started, it sort of snowballs, and you have more and more fun as you wake up more and more. Even the food which you taste becomes more delicious. If you think that the cooking here is delicious, you wait until the last day. That's when you get the best meal. Not because the cook puts more spices or whatever else she does into the food, simply because your mindfulness gets more and more subtle, more and more still, you can pick up more. And this is why we have a happy time on this retreat, as we build up that power of mindfulness. So to summarize what I've been saying, you can actually program your mindfulness, tell yourself exactly what you're doing, which is dealing with that part of mindfulness which is the instructions, knowing what you're supposed to be doing. So at least you have a direction there, rather than just allowing the mind to go all over the place. So at the beginning of each stage of the meditation, tell yourself exactly what you want to do and what you don't want to do. Just tell that mindfulness, don't keep on at that mindfulness again and again, like in the simile of the taxi driver. Just do it clearly at the beginning, and then let the mind do the job. If after 5 or 10 minutes you're still wandering around, okay, repeat the instructions again. But very quickly, very clearly, so you're not always telling your mind what to do, not giving it enough time to follow those instructions. And that way you get very clear what you're supposed to be doing. And the mind knows what it's supposed to be doing. And at the same time, the awareness will start to grow. Because all these instructions are telling you how to be still, how to stop moving so fast. So just like in my simile of the car, you're not looking at life speeding along. You're getting slower and slower and slower. You see more, and what you see is more enjoyable, which makes you stop even more easily, as you want to linger and enjoy every moment. That shows that mindfulness is getting stronger and stronger. And it's great, because when you have such strong mindfulness, the meditation is so easy to do. If you feel like you're more in control. Instead of like driving through the fog, you're driving in the bright sunlight, and you can see all the signs, and of course you get to your direction without getting lost. Because the mind is woken up. You're alert and ready to go. So that's the talk today on mindfulness, with its two parts, and the place of effort as well. Okay, any questions about that talk? Yes?
My understanding you clearly, when you say you give the instructions to begin at the stage, so if you say, for example, sit for a longer sit, you might start to be real restlessness, Are you saying that at each of those stages you can stop, put pause button on, give instructions, move through that stage?
Yes. So even like nimitta stage, you know, you got this beautiful, 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 beautiful breath, and nimittas are starting to come up. You just pause and say, "Now I'll go to that nimitta. I'll be so still as I watch it. I'll just go to that nimitta. I'll be so still. I'll go to that nimitta. I'll be so still inside." Whatever instructions you give yourself, or I think because you've been to many of these retreats, you've probably read that book. One of the things which I did, when you get to the nimitta, I said, "I'm the driver of the car, now I hand the keys over to the nimitta. Been driving my car, now nimitta, you take the keys. Driving the car, nimitta, you take the keys." It was like a metaphor for letting go and for not doing anything anymore. "Okay, you drive now. I've got this far, now it's up to you." Any little suggestion like that actually is very helpful. It has to be clear. And I usually repeat it 3 times, just because, you know, that's what's usually done in Buddhism, you know. Dutiyampi, Tatiyampi, 3 refuges. You know, you take the 3 refuges 3 times. But it seems to help doing things 3 times. It reinforces the instructions.
Specifically, at that point where the limiters are, say, so I thought it was very clear about that. Look how super difficult it is, super about at that point, isn't it?
Yes, it did, yeah. You can make sort of little resolutions of exactly what you're supposed to be doing. Because that's what aditana, making it very clear what you want to do. Resolving, and like, you know, resolution means, you know, clarity. So you're not sort of wandering around not knowing where you're... You know where you're going, but you don't know why you're going there or what you're supposed to be doing. So sometimes that mindfulness, people, I know I was asleep. They don't know what they're supposed to be doing there instead of being asleep. Yeah, I know I was thinking of my girlfriend back home, but you know, I'm not supposed to be doing that. So mindfulness is also remembering the instructions. As I said yesterday with a simile of the garden, the burglars coming in. It's not just noting, yeah, the burglars are there. It's knowing that they're not supposed to be there, and it's a job you're supposed to be doing if the burglars come. So mindfulness is awareness plus also remembering the instructions. And to be able to remember those instructions, you have to give those instructions first.
Does the mindfulness, as it does, actually super mindfulness, like you've been referring to it, does the sense of will spontaneously decrease and be taken, being replaced by the aditanas that you're talking about?
Correct, yeah. The stronger the mindfulness, just the clearer you are seeing, and the easier it is for you to remember. That's why that source of that mindfulness, developing mindfulness, is used as a skillful means to, you know, for learning very easily. Whether it's a school or university or you're just going to some sort of conference, the more mindfulness you have, the easier it is to remember things. It just sticks because you're paying full attention. So when you get to those deep mindfulness, it's just a small little instruction, and the mind is just like this so obedient dog. You just tell it to go and fetch the slippers, and it runs off, wagging its tail ferociously, and comes back with your slippers. Sometimes dripping with saliva, but who cares? The dog had a good time. Yeah, in the corner. Yeah?
Would you mind going through the instructions for the third and fourth stages?
Okay, with the breath. Okay, you've got to tell yourself what you want to focus on and what you want to avoid. Because sometimes it's not enough to say what you're supposed to be doing. It helps to remind yourself what you're not supposed to be doing. So I always say, I'm going to watch the feeling of the breath. To me, I just say, watch the breath, because I know what I mean by that. Because I know what my instructions mean, but if I say to you, watch your breath, you may not know, what am I supposed to watch? That's why yesterday I gave the explanation, you watch that sensation, that feeling, which tells you the breath is going in or breath is going out. I call that the breath. So you can tell yourself, you know, I'm going to watch what tells me and I'm breathing in or breathing out. So you give yourself a clear instruction of what you're supposed to be doing. Don't say watch the tip of the nose, because that just creates a lot of problems for people. You don't watch the breath at one particular part of the body, it's wherever it happens to be manifesting. A few years ago, when people, I always used to have this problem in some traditions where people were getting headaches when they were meditating. And it was always because they were watching the tip of the nose. And the headaches were sort of just above their eyes. And the reason was, as one monk pointed out to me, and it was an obvious explanation, is that if they had their eyes closed, if their actually eyes were open, and they were watching their breath at the tip of the nose, they'd be doing this. They were cross-eyed. Because if you put your attention there, your eyes would, you know, subconsciously go to the same place. You can imagine doing this for half an hour or an hour. No wonder you get a headache. So don't watch it at any one place. It's a saying that we used to learn this technique of watching at your stomach and your tummy. Now watch your stomach go up and down. And that was also terrible. You try that this afternoon, maybe about 6 or 7 o'clock, when you're hungry. It's so close to your stomach. You start thinking about food, not with the breath going up and down. So that didn't work. So don't have to worry about where you watch the breath, as long as you're aware of the breath. And you say, what am I not supposed to be aware of at that time? And you should already got rid of, you know, most of the thoughts. I should not be aware now of other feelings in the body. Just focus on the breath, nor sounds outside. That's not my business. So just on the breath. And then, if you really want to go on to the full awareness of the breath, I'm going to be, not just watch breath go in and out, I'm going to watch the very beginning of each in-breath, right to the end of the in-breath, beginning of the out-breath, right to the end of the out-breath. I give myself clear instructions of what I'm supposed to be doing. And then the mind knows what to do, and very often the mind says, thank you for telling me. So now I know exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. It makes it much easier for me. And then so the mindfulness can follow that, backwards and forwards. And if it wanders off, the mind will say, come on, you wandered off, back you go, onto the breath again. Because you've given yourself instructions, mindfulness will keep you on the task. Yes?
How do you focus on my breathing? What I do is I count from 1 to 100 and start again from 1 to 100. By this counting method, does it hinder me from going on to the next stage?
No, it doesn't hinder. If you're doing some counting, don't do it too much, because otherwise, again, you get headache because counting too much. And you can count, there's many different ways to do counting with the breath, but you do it as almost like a support, like a crutch for a while. And then see if you can get to the place you can watch the breath without the counting. So you can do the breath with the counting, and then when you think that you've got the breath in mind, stop the counting and just know the breath without the counts. It's the same in the Thai forest tradition. They would watch the breath with a mantra, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. Breathing in, they'd say to themselves, Buddha, breathing out, to, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. It helped, you know, keep their attention on the breath. You can try that yourself if you wish, the Buddha method. But it always has to come a time when you drop the Buddha and you just watch the breath without any supports. And as the mind becomes more peaceful, you should be able to do that. So do the counting, but then after a while, let go of the counting. And just watch the breath without any support.
You mentioned earlier about the burglar and the attention as that burglar is aware of people taking attention, and mindfulness has to be there also to say, don't take this as being a lesson. Sometimes you teach meditation like a free-thinking guy doesn't know what comes into mind, past, present, or future. Disallow it to be, so you're attentive, but you disallow anything to happen.
Yeah.
How does that fit in with the instruction you just gave about mindfulness should stop certain things happening but allow certain other things?
What I've just said today is almost like the Mercedes-Benz of meditation, the letting go is the Rolls-Royce method. But many people just can't handle a Rolls-Royce. They can't really let go properly. So, you know, these are almost like tricks to get you to that same stage. Because the reason why we do have the difficulties, the reason why we do not watch the breath, that we start thinking, fantasizing, or fall asleep, because we're actually doing something. We're escaping, we're controlling, we're manufacturing, we're making. And instead of asking someone to let go completely in one hit, we just say, okay, gently, just let go this much, now let go a little bit more, now let go a bit more, now let go a bit more. But the Rolls Royce is just to sit there and absolutely do nothing. You've got to be aware you're doing nothing. And so often that people think they're doing nothing, but they're actually getting involved and doing a bit of this and doing a bit of that. They're not clear enough to see what they're doing. They're getting involved. And basically, Rodney, the big problem is the sense of self. Because whenever there's a self there, there's a sense of ownership. And whatever we own, we tend to control. And that creates the activity of doing. So the more we can actually sort of let go of the sense of possession and ownership of our mind, of our body, of our meditation, the easier it is just to abandon and let things go. There's very few people who can actually do that. So the best way is completely let go. And as you go deeper in this meditation retreat, you know, that's the time you should maybe try the Rolls Royce. Once you've learned how to drive the Mercedes. And sometimes it just happens, sometimes that people just, they're just in the right mood, they can do the full letting go. And sometimes they're just sitting there and bam, they really get into these amazing deep meditation states. And you know, they just press the letting go button. It's important for me to let you know that such a button exists. If you can just find that and just press that and let go fully, wow, you don't need to do any of the other stuff. That's how you can get into deep meditations quickly. Does that sort of answer the great question?
It's just in relation to when you say letting go, or just letting go, you know, anything to arise, so when you say the ego is there, or so if the mind goes off and follows a train of thought, so like a football or something, and it goes off in that direction, is that what you mean by the mind
being involved? Correct, yes. If you really do letting go, and the thought of football comes up, and it can't go anywhere. There's nothing to drive it. Sometimes I describe that as having a mind like a padded cell. Nothing bounces off the walls. It just goes squelch and stops moving. That's real letting go. So things come up, whatever it is, and they don't bounce. There's nothing to keep them going. So just things arise and stop. And there's so much stopping that everything stops. Yeah?
I thought that in the perception of probably from too much concentration.
Okay. Are there weird perceptions from too much concentration? I don't like the word concentration for samadhi. Because it gives the idea it comes from willpower. Sure, you can get a degree of concentration from willpower, but it has a limit. You come across a brick wall sooner or later, which you can't get beyond. Which is why I prefer these days samadhi as stages of letting go, stillness. Stillness is perhaps a preferred word these days, because stillness gives you the idea that you cannot make stillness happen. You can't, and this is the old story, which I've given a simile quite a few times. Venerable Radha, could you open your eyes a minute to help me out here? Quite honest, I'm going to try and hold this cup of water still. Is it still yet?
It's wobbling.
Okay, I'll try harder. I'm really trying hard now. I'm concentrating. And of course, I could do this for half an hour, all day. I've never yet been able to hold a cup of water absolutely still. So how can I get this water absolutely still? Put it down. Now you find it's moving more than it did before. It always does when you first let go. It moves more. But then you leave it alone. Yeah, it's still. Now that's actually what I mean by samadhi. You can hold the mind and it gets almost still, but it can't go any further. But when you let it go and put it down, then it becomes absolutely still. And you can never hold water that still. Now that's why these are stages of letting go. Peace which is born of disengagement. And when that happens, these aren't sort of what happens from concentration, they happen from stillness. It's a power which comes from the still mind. And they're not, they're weird states, but they're not dangerous states, and they're great fun. And this is, you don't have a TV to watch during this meditation retreat, no movies, but you can have your own movie, your own weird TV show, sitting down there with all the lights and the razzmatazz, with your eyes closed, having a great old time. And for some meditation teachers say you shouldn't indulge in this, but I say, yeah, get into it. Simply because it doesn't last that long, and you get a bit of a payoff from your meditation. It just shows you just what the mind can do. So you can sit there looking at the carpet and going, wow, that's amazing. Enjoy it. It's just a little harmless reward from all the good meditation you've done so far. I'm sure it's weird, only because it's unusual. Well, you know what it is. It's not weird, it's just natural, that's all. It's the natural abilities of the mind starting to manifest. And it just shows you what mindfulness can do. And it inspires you, you get a lot of fun out of that. It doesn't send you crazy at all. It just give you a big smile on your face for the day, and then you can go deeper afterwards. Yeah?
So, very instructive, as you were talking, you were talking about last night, is that in mindfulness, gentleness would seem to be very important.
Because being able to be still, you have to be gentle. Even when we're holding it, there's force there. It's aggression. It's almost violence. And we do violence to our mind all the time. Come on, watch the breath. Come on, sit down. Sit an extra 5 minutes. Forget about the aches in your knees or whatever. We're sometimes so violent, especially men, to their mind, let alone their body. So we're just so gentle and calm. Just like a mother loves her only child. So we love our breath. We don't strangle it. We just love it. And then we just always love looking at our breath. We can't take our eyes away from things we love. And it's just there for us. And we're there for it. That's how we stay with these things. How we produce the stability of the mind called stillness. So notice any violence you have towards your meditation, which often comes from frustration. When it doesn't work, too many people think we should try harder. We're going to dominate our mind. If kindness doesn't work, the last resort, we're going to beat the hell out of our mind just to teach it a lesson. And of course it never works. So just be very gentle and kind. Remember, this meditation was taught by the Buddha. So sometimes, whenever I think of getting violent and aggressive to my mind, I think, no, come on, you should have a Buddha mind. As if, like, you know, it's a Buddha inside me, just looking at my meditation. What would the Buddha say? Ah, never mind. It's all right. There's beautiful gentleness and calmness and acceptance and non-judgmental attitude. As soon as I look upon my meditation object, pretending I'm a Buddha looking at my meditation object, then it gets just so soft and kind. And all the aggression, all the violence just fades away. And it's more peaceful. So that's, you know, a little bit of Buddha Anusati, reflection of a Buddha. Imagine you're a Buddha meditating. Imagine the Buddha is commenting on your meditation. Just, it's good enough, well done. And it stops the aggression. Is that a question? Or is that just saying how? Okay, John.
It's a meditation day. Wouldn't you actually, it's a good idea to look at the mind before you start? It's like a job, you know, you look at the mind, what states the mind in, and how I approach it. Because it's just one method. It could be a number of methods. Like, I mean, Ajahn Brahmari teaches, it's a lot of thought, it's just, it's very defensive.
Good, yeah. You're saying that when you start meditation, you look upon it like it's a carpenter and they've got a job, which means like a task ahead of themselves. You should do that. That's one of the similes in my book. The carpenter simile. And every time you look at the mind, it needs a different technique to start off with. If it is really tired because you just got up in the morning, maybe walking meditation is the best. Or some loving kindness if you're a bit negative. Or so if you're really tired, do what we call flat out meditation. I think you know what that means. On your bed, letting go. And sometimes breath meditation, just make peace, as I say, if you've got lots of thoughts there. Yeah, it's good. What you're saying is very true. And that's actually a nice thing which I missed out. A thing which I missed out from the mindfulness talk. Mindfulness, to start with, look at your mind, see what it needs. Because it doesn't always need the same thing at the same time. The same thing every time. Thank you, John. Yes? Last question and interview, yeah. Is there anything in between? The Mercedes voice. Because sometimes you just flip them a little bit between the two of them. Loving kindness is probably between the two of them. Because in loving kindness, if you do it properly, the door of my heart's always open to whatever's happening now. It's just a way of letting go. Because you're open. Or another meditation which I'll teach later on, which is a very effective one, is a no-measuring meditation. So, whatever's happening, you don't measure it. You don't even give it a name, good or bad, peaceful or restless. And it's very powerful, because when you don't give things a name, you can't get hold of them. You can't measure them, because you can't get hold of them and measure them, you can't do anything about it. It's a wonderful way of letting go. A no measuring meditation. I'll teach that later on. Okay, so enough talk and chit chat. Now is the time to program your mindfulness. And tell yourself what you're going to do in the next half an hour, 45 minutes or hour, and just see if you can just gently over the next couple of days, get this feeling of really waking up and being more alive, more alert. And you find that the birds actually sound more beautiful in the morning, and just the sunshine, you can feel it more on your face. And the wind is just so sensuous and so nice. And you can wake up more and enjoy those feelings, because it shows you that mindfulness is increasing. So get off on it. Okay, have a nice meditation this morning.